Mini-episode 1904 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at Sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late-night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode 1904. You have with you here today two football-talking luminaries here in the lounge, but officially FDH Lounge dignitaries, Rick Morris, Derek Allen, coming at you to discuss Super Bowl 60 in the Bay Area. And we just had what passed for a Pro Bowl these days, if you even want to call it that, last night as we're taping this here. But on to Super Bowl week here. As we get another one of these rematches that we get sometimes in the course of Super Bowl history, New England and Seattle. That one ended very memorably a decade or so ago. I don't know if perhaps we're going to be bringing out Marshawn Lynch for the ceremonial coin toss at the beginning of the game or not. I don't think he would appreciate if that were the case. But this is a matchup that, again, nobody would have seen coming back in August necessarily, but the way that it played out through the course of the season, they'd been two of the higher seeds throughout the course of the season, Derek, and here we end up with this being our matchup.
Yeah, I mean, I think we had talked about this last time we had met. Like, it's a compelling one, and it's definitely two of the best teams. I think one of the funny, just right off the bat, before we talk about predictions, I think one of the funniest things has just been who everyone's just rooting for, not even who they think you're going to win. It feels very much everyone is like, I feel like the crowd is much, including myself, are much behind Seattle because I'm not going to live. I'll die before I live through two Patriot dynasties in my lifetime.
Yeah, I mean, I think Boston fans alone tip the scale decisively here in terms of who America is looking at. Because, for most people in America, the next person that they meet from Seattle who really annoys them, at least sports-wise, if we get into other stuff like that, if anybody starts yapping too much about the grunge music of their youth or anything like that, okay, that could be a little off-putting. But, you know, as far as sports takes go, yeah, nobody from Seattle, I don't think, really causes any beer to spill down at the VFW Hall versus Boston fans. So, yeah, I think you're right about that. I think it's pretty simple where America's sympathies lie. Count myself in there. I'm not going to be sitting here rooting for any Boston sports fans to get over. And this is ultimately a game where, you know, as you said, through the course of the year, they were two of the top teams coming in. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to bring up here and highlight on our FDH end of regular season, breakdown end of the regular season with our statistics. And just to kind of give the audience, at least the audience that is checking this out on the old visual here, that's partaking of it that way, a chance to see what's going on here as we get into some of the different aspects between the teams. And these teams are really, well, that's not the screen, actually. These teams are very much both in bringing a lot in the way of ultimately a good amount of strengths defensively on the part of both teams. Here we go. And this is something where when you go to compare between the teams, you have an awful lot of, again, defensively, if you look at it on the surface, some similarities here. Seattle first, New England seventh overall in the composite rankings between the teams here. And for strength of schedule, for New England, that's one of the big things that jumps out. 32nd in the league, Seattle 7th. So that's one of the biggest points of separation, is that Seattle being, as you know all full well about, Derek, the NFC West, what they're able to do, if banging heads on a regular basis versus the season that New England ended up having, which I don't think it's necessarily being unfair to them to say it's one of the dominant reasons that they are here on this stage. Third down offense for Seattle, a little bit of kind of stubbing their toe. It's really the only thing where they're subpar in any way, and even in that case, it's more so middle of the pack. For New England, you've got 10th in DSRS, 10th in defensive yards per play, 12th in third down defense, and defensive yards per play, 12th on both of those. They were 10th. New England was 10th on our end of regular season power rankings. So as far as just the numbers from that point of view, is there anything that really kind of jumps out at you between the two teams here that you think could be decisive on Sunday?
I mean, you already mentioned the strength of schedule, which is, you know, I think it's why kind of, you know, from the going into the playoffs, and even I think when we had met at like the mid or whenever it was the last before playoffs, you know, I talked about New England and Denver, and I threw the Bears on there as well, just for good measure, as sort of my false prophets of, you know, the top teams, I think, and the strength of schedule, I think, kind of proves that. Now, obviously, New England does have a pretty good defense, but, you know, it's pretty two evenly matched teams. I mean, obviously, Seattle has a lot of points there over them, but then, you know, you see some other pieces where New England has the advantage. So it's hard to, other than strength of schedule, it's hard to really point at something and see, you know, a massive spread in between these two teams.
Well, and interestingly enough, if you were going to do that, one of the points where there's at least 10 points worth of difference here would be third down offense. As I said before, Seattle a little bit mediocre in that, 16th, New England 6th. So in one of the areas on this, even though Seattle scores out way better than New England, because again, as always, the lower the score, the better. New England, the top of the first tier with 37 points. New England, the bottom of the second tier of teams with 101 points. But that is an area where, again, New England is 10 points higher than on the third down offense. And when you look at the rest of them, though, again, the fact that it's funny that, like, what Seattle is worst on out of any of this stuff, aside from that, is strength of schedule, and they're 7th. So that's got to be kind of a difficult thing for New England to be looking at that. If you're looking at areas of vulnerability, you're really not going to find them there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. What McDonald's done with that defense, as well as the offense, and just, you know, in that quick turnaround, it's insane. I mean, and you can make the same point with Vrabel. So I think the coaching piece is going to really come into play. I mean, I don't know if – obviously neither of them have coached in a Super Bowl before. I think Vrabel's played in one. So but it's that part's going to be – I mean, it's one of the more evenly matched Super Bowls. But, you know, I could be dead wrong and Seattle just stomps them, you know, like a la the that whatever 2013, where they just destroyed that Peyton Manning Broncos team. But no, I think it's going to be pretty evenly matched.
Well, one of the things that people are looking at here is the fact that, again, with New England having faced one of the worst schedules that, I mean, it's not just the worst one this year. It's one of the worst schedules that anybody's faced in a long period of time as far as having to play anybody. Getting to the playoffs here and maybe getting exposed a little bit, especially with the offensive line, all the additional pressure that May has been put under. And that, again, this is a thing where the jump up that New England has made under the circumstances here, again, it is the biggest turnaround that we've seen for a team to make the Super Bowl, in as much as having 13 losses in 2024. It's unprecedented to go to the Super Bowl the next year. So, I mean, they show every sign of being a team that is playing sort of ahead of its time here, and a team that might grow into the quote-unquote worthiness of being here at some point. But that, I think it's fair to say they're here because of the specific circumstances of the AFC in this year. And when again, you know, you look at the circumstances with the offensive line, what's happened now that they're playing better defenses. They have been really, really, really pressed the whole way with the defenses that they've been playing against. And they're not, they have yet to even play against the biggest monster in the league, Seattle. So for the people that are saying that they think that it may not be a close game, and I don't think it's going to be a blowout, but I don't think it's going to be particularly close either. That's what people like me are going off of, is just that, again, what the trends have been from New England since they started having to play the best of the best, if you will, in the playoffs versus what they played in the regular season and how they've come out and responded offensively.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. I mean, even when you look at the Houston game, which I think you can say was a pretty big blowout, Houston was in that game with that defense. They were doing everything they could. It was obviously that offense couldn't, get a single yard, it felt like, and especially in that second half. But and then you kind of saw something similar with Denver, another good defense that, held them. But again, the offenses they were playing weak offenses. So in this playoff so far, we have New England's defense is good, but we haven't seen them. They played, a backup quarterback, and then they played, a sputtering Houston. So it'll be interesting again when that defense is up against an actual all-star offense like Seattle's been.
Yeah. Because there's nothing that necessarily indicates that they would be up to the challenge with that. Conversely, Mike McDonald, what he's been able to do against first and second year quarterbacks, that's when that defense has been at its very most vicious. And this is where the questions have been coming in about Drake May through the course of the playoffs here, is that for a New England team to make the Super Bowl, you would not expect that he would look like a somewhat green second-year quarterback. He really didn't through the course of the year, in a year where he has contended for and may still win the MVP for the season. But that's how it's played out, that we haven't seen the Drake May that we've expected to see, and yet they're still in the Super Bowl. Conversely, Sam Darnold, and I've been saying this all along, and again, as a guy who said back in 2018, yeah, the Browns should take him with the first pick overall.
Would it have been any different if he started in the Jets or the Browns?
Well, the formerly we, because I'm off of the Browns at this point, I think possibly until Haslam sells them, because they're going to be a dumpster fire till that's the point. But they were we for me back in the day, and we would have just ruined him, as did the Jets, as did the Panthers. It's remarkable that he's been able to overcome that. And I've been saying now through the course of the last 2 years, as he's really proven what he can do, to me, he's the Jim Plunkett of this era. And I think me saying that, it may actually take off, and it may actually be a thing people believe if they win this Super Bowl, that it will be a thing. Because if you look at that, I'm hard pressed to think of anybody else in the history of the game where it kind of goes the same way. Somebody comes out with all kinds of incredible billing at the start of their career, gets labeled a bust, and then gets to the right situation and is able to turn it around. I mean, I think that's what's waiting for him if he wins this game, is everybody looking at him, or everybody who is commonsensical, looking at him the way that I do, as far as having a Jim Plunkett type of redemption arc to his career.
Yeah, I mean, I thought we were kind of already there after what he did last year in Minnesota, but
yeah,
100% agree. And maybe this is going to be the new trend GM start to go look for someone that was a bust that started off at a low tier franchise, like the Jets or the Browns or the Cardinals or the Panthers, and then bring him in. Cause I mean, now like he wasn't the starter. We saw what Mac Jones did in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. We've obviously Baker's redemption these last couple years in Tampa. So I mean, there's clearly something there, but obviously Darnold has the chance to be sort of the king of that if he pulls this off, which we'll see.
Well, and what's always been my 1A team, which has gotten my primary attachment here ever since the Browns signed Deshaun Watson, that being the Miami Dolphins, I'm very excited to see that they may be in the mix for Malik Willis, because I certainly think that he's another one of these guys here with what he flashed in Green Bay. I mean, and you go all the way back, and this is all the way back, but Green Bay is sort of being the incubator of quarterbacks for other teams, going back to like Mark Brunell. So, I think it could happen again. Now, Brunell was never somebody that was a bust. He was just somebody where, you know, they drafted him explicitly for the purposes of developing him and flipping him, versus Malik Willis was a bust in Tennessee, quite frankly. But like you're saying, there is the chance that, you know, this could become a thing. Look, if teams are deciding to go in that direction, I mean, the Browns alone could keep the NFL going on this for decades with the churn out of failed quarterbacks that they've had. So, you know, if that becomes a trend, then a lot of people will be coming to the Berea complex not far from my home to see what they can get tape on and who might be available out there in the market. But as far as just some of the other oddities about the game here as well, as far as some of the matchups go, this is I think that these were names that came up in our previous discussion here when we were looking at the playoffs for this year. But to me, one of the big stories of the game is because one of the most important positions in the game is shutdown cornerback. And the last couple of years and the last couple of drafts between Christian Gonzalez and Devin Witherspoon, I mean, we've got two grade A examples of it right there. And you could very easily see the game coming down to which of these guys performs better under the circumstances. There's a non-zero chance that it could come down to that.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the biggest pieces I've seen a lot of the talking heads talk through is just, again, that, like, how that JSN versus Gonzalez matchup's going to go. And, I mean, I 100%, like, JSN, I think, is when you look at just every game, it's very funny that we haven't looked at him this season as you look at, you know, Ja'Marr Chase in past seasons or Justin Jefferson. He kind of just is. No one really talks about him that way, but he catches everything he gets. I mean, his reception totals are off the charts. So it will be interesting. I mean, if you can effectively take him out of the game, it will be interesting to see how Darnold reacts. But I do think that one of the advantages, and maybe you disagree, is that Seattle feels like they have more weapons on offense than New England does.
I absolutely agree. Yeah, I mean, you look at New England, and again, I think a large part of the case for Drake May for MVP is that he did it with that receiving core. I mean,
like
I think
Henry and like who else? Like,
yeah, I mean, it's that's absolutely the case. I mean, and you look at like, oh well, you know, Shahid hasn't been a real big part of the Seattle offense since he got there. He's been mostly special teams. He would be one of the most important parts of the New England offense if he got inserted there tomorrow, okay? So I agree with you completely on that. At running back, New England has the two-headed horse here that Seattle's not going to have with Charbonnet being down at this point in time here. But, I mean, it hasn't hurt him so far having to just rely on Walker at this point. And when you look at the defensive side of the ball, you know, this is a term that I've used for many years on the show. I remember, you know, first going back to this probably about a decade or so ago and using the term on and off. But for someone with actual cavalry experience here, the term force multiplier, which I know first spawned out of military talk and strategy and whatever. Like, I'm always looking for players that I feel like are a force multiplier defensively. And tell me that Nick Amunwari hasn't become that guy, like, from day one for Seattle. I think he's one of the biggest reasons that this defense is where it is, and that his ability to make everybody around him better and to sort of be the glue of that thing as a rookie speaks to what will be a Hall of Fame career if that guy stays healthy.
Oh, 100%. I mean, Seattle continues to just draft super well and just get lucky with these defenses they put together, doing like a sort of Frankenstein of great draft picks, some you know, wily veterans, and then obviously throwing in some good, you know, mid-tier, you know, free agent pulls. But yeah, I mean, the defense is going to be absolutely unstoppable. I actually saw one thing that's going to be interesting though is kind of what kind of coverage we see with the safeties. I saw Romo talking about it the other recently about look at where. Both of these teams kind of start the game in terms of their safety concepts. If, like, I think he was saying, you know, watch Seattle start with two high, watch New England start with one high, and just kind of see how it goes. And that play combined with both these defensive lines and these run games are effective, but I wouldn't call them dominant, if that makes sense. I don't think it's going to be a heavy run game. I think it's going to be, honestly, I think it's going to be a dink and dump down the field. Each team is going to do it. And then it's going to, who the winner is going to depend on who makes the most mistakes or the least mistakes. And then who can get, you know, one or two of those big chunk plays. Can, you know, can they, can Seattle pull off, you know, a vertical down the line and JSN wins in single coverage. Like if that happens, those are kind of the markers I'm looking at. Cause again, these defenses are just both too good.
They are. And that's where, again, when you're talking about that and the scenarios where the defenses can make the biggest mark, in the case of the New England defense, there's not really much of a vulnerability for the Seattle offense, except the interior of the line is pretty mid. So, I mean, if you're going to be able to get any pressure coming on Darnold from up the middle, that would be the one way to go about it. Conversely, this is one of these things where, again, much like you would not have expected New England to make it all the way through the playoffs with Drake May, looking significantly worse than he did through the regular season, you wouldn't have expected New England to even make the playoffs, or maybe you would have just because of that schedule, but you wouldn't have expected them to be in a Super Bowl if Will Campbell, the very decorated first-round draft pick at tackle, if you knew that he was going to struggle the way that he has. So that's a guy that, like, they could be looking at him like fresh meat there on the Seattle side as far as what they can do. You got to believe that New England is going to be scheming up a lot to try to protect him, I would think.
For sure. I do think the advantage that New England has in terms of going against the pass rush is Darnold's not mobile, but Drake is clearly a lot more mobile. I think we saw it in the Denver game a couple of times where, you know, he had a couple clutch improv runs that ended up either getting them the first down or getting, you know, a second and long right into a makeable third down range. Darnold's capable of that a little bit, but not, I don't think, to the level. And obviously it makes sense. He's a little bit of an older quarterback when compared to Drake May. So that's, I think, the edge. That edge I would put to New England in terms of, you know, going against the pass rush. If Seattle can get the pass rush going, I think if they both can get a good pass rush going, I still think New England kind of walks out of that with, you know, the favorable marks.
You would think so, yeah. If they can do that, and I would expect them to be able to do that to a large degree. The other part of it is here too, and that as much as we've already seen from a viewership standpoint, I think a very tainted AFC championship game vis-a-vis having to watch a backup quarterback out there for Denver. The non-zero chance that we may be doing the same thing in the Super Bowl here, because maybe it's just brave talk, kayfabing, whatever on the part of New England, like, oh, May's shoulder isn't that bad, really. But, like, if it turns out that it is, and if he's out there and not only having to try to up the quality of his play that he's shown throughout the playoffs against by far the best defense that he's seen thus far, but doing so at significantly less than 100%, then that's a recipe for the game to get ugly right there.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, like, how was that shoulder injury in the Denver game? I'm trying to remember.
I think he got hit on it, and, you know, they're trying to say now it's not that big of a thing. And, you know, I think May was trying to do the whole "it feels fine" thing, which, again, anytime that you're in the playoffs in any sport, those are some of the emptiest words that you can say, is that it feels fine. As though we're supposed to take that at face value. So, I mean, that may turn out to be the case. It may not. This may be overblown. But if it's not overblown, any of the concern about his shoulder at this point in time, again, look at the Seattle-San Francisco playoff game there. I mean, that was not a game. I certainly didn't expect it to get out of hand. I really didn't. I had Seattle, you know, making it through to the NFC Championship game and only losing because of the level of regard that I had for the Rams. But ultimately, yeah, it's one of these situations where I really think that, you know, we could see a game much like we saw with the San Francisco game in the playoffs, or, again, like the Seattle-Denver game about a decade or so ago in the Super Bowl. If May is in any way, shape, or form not completely good to go and not looking as sharp as he's looked during the season, and again, some of that you can control. You can't control how sharp you look if the defense, if the best defense in the league is really at its peak and whatever. But if you're playing up to your best level, dealing with that, then you still have whatever amount of chance, theoretically, if you can make plays here or there, and especially get your own defense to do you some really big solids. But again, I think any chance that New England has whatsoever in this one gets just completely vaporized if any of the concerns about May are at all valid.
Yeah, I'm trying to look at who their backups are. I'm like, do they still have Zappe there?
I think that was one of the guys that was part of the revolving door for the Browns in the last 2 years or so.
They were like the last 2 years, they had a couple,
you're even thinking of somebody. I could have sworn Zappe did a tour of duty on the North Coast. I maybe misremembered. Okay. I may be misremembering that. Is Brian Hoyer still there? Is Steve Grogan still there?
I'm pulling up their roster because I'm genuinely curious because I didn't even. Okay. I was like, yeah, I didn't really think of who would kind of come in if May has to come out.
What about Drew Bledsoe?
Oh my god! Oh, that's interesting. So their number two or their May's backup is Josh Dobbs.
Oh, okay. All right.
Well, and then their third string, if that somehow happened, is the Paisan himself, Tommy DeVito. So they have guys that can win you a game for sure.
Well, we are headed for record Super Bowl low ratings. If anything happens to Drake May, if those guys are the backups. And I say this as somebody who is a Tennessee Vols honk who really wanted Josh Dobbs to look good for the Browns when he was here. And it did not happen. So
yeah.
If those are the guys, if that's the thin blue line that you've got for Patriots fan, is those guys, that this thing's done. Roger Goodell will be committing Harry Carey by halftime if those guys end up making it into the game. So that's where – and it's surprising to me with New England being a young team where this is something where – and again, not that any team out there necessarily goes and spends a mint on their backup quarterback, but New England is not, to my knowledge, anywhere near being cap-strapped. So I know that they'll never admit this, right? They'll never admit that this unfolded quicker than they thought. They'll tell you, we knew it all along. But still, it's a situation where if you thought there was any chance that you were going to be in this kind of a situation, you wouldn't be rolling in with Josh Dobbs and Tommy DeVito. You just wouldn't.
Vrabel must trust them.
Well, I mean – we saw the way that his quarterback play went in Tennessee a lot over the years, so I don't know if I'm going to put a whole lot on Mike Vrabel getting sticky quarterback decisions right. But
who do you give the coaching edge to?
I give it to Seattle. I really do. I've always thought that. I can't knock the work that Vrabel did in New England, and he's taken a young team. Then again. Yeah. But like, I always thought that like in Tennessee, it was one of those things where, and this is the whole thing too. And I just, some of this is sort of my cultural criticism towards football fans is I kind of look askance at a lot of the coaches that I feel tend to get super fluffed by like, he looks like a football coach, damn it. And like Vrabel's like the poster child for that. Like, look at that guy. I just,
Dan Campbell, yeah.
Yeah, I think he gets overrated because of that. So I just – it's one of those things where I give it to McDonald. I mean, I think McDonald's a genius. I have thought so even before he got the Seattle job. It was one of those things where – and I will tell you this. I mean, as a lifelong North Coaster, just the delight that I have right now at all the Baltimore Ratbird fans are like, we could have had him. There were a lot of them that were saying it at the time. I remember, fire Harbaugh, don't let him go. In retrospect, those people who were getting denounced as lunatics at the time, they were right. McDonald is such a sharp guy. And that's where, again, I've said to you, like, this is where In the case of Arizona, you better hope you're getting it right, because in that, you talk about a murderer's row in that division with McDonald, McVay, and Shanahan. I would not envy anybody ending up being the fourth coach in that division. So McDonald is very, very close to the top of my list of coaches for the league. And not that I wouldn't put Vrabel in the top 10, I would, but there's a difference between one or two or three and, you know, eight or nine or 10, essentially. That's how I look at it. How do you see the coaches?
I don't know. I somewhat disagree. I do think sometimes we go, like, that's a football coach. But mm-hmm. I do think sometimes that's necessary. I think you've seen it with the turnaround in Detroit. Now, Campbell and I think Vrabel, like, we put in the same boat. They're not the X's and O's guys. They're going to rely – they're going to live and die by their coordinators. We have seen that in Detroit, you know, mm-hmm. when Johnson leaves and they, you know, didn't make the playoffs. So, but I – to make that initial turnaround, I do think you need a guy like that. Or, you know, you bring in, again, like what McDonald, Chip, like these young guys have all done in those programs. So you can go one way or the other, but it's more difficult to find the young guy that's going to be really good than find mm-hmm. the good leader and just give them great coordinators and hope for the best.
Yeah. And again, it is a completely different way of going about it that these two organizations have shown at this point in time, as far as how they're doing it. I think, again, McDonald is showing also that he's a very good leader of men, but that's not the first thing that he's known for. The first thing he's known for is being one of the very smartest men on the planet when it comes to defense. And he's really living up to that end of the bargain there. And ultimately, yeah, I mean, when you go to see just how this has unfolded with these teams here and the paths that they have taken to get to this game. And just the fact that, again, it's remarkable, again, this being a Super Bowl rematch. And ultimately, in Super Bowl rematches, the team that has won the first game, they are 6-3 in the second game. So if you're a Patriots fan looking for something to hold on to, it would be that. But them being there when they were, and then both of them being back here at this point, when it's a complete turnover, coaches, quarterbacks, I highly doubt that there's a player who actually even geared up for either one of those teams that's in the same jersey today. I don't think that's the case at all. It's just been a complete turnover, and that's what's been remarkable. And they've taken different paths to get there. Is New England really kind of bottomed out post-Belichick? And for Seattle, they've just been kind of gliding along a little bit. I mean, they got to a point, I think, at the latter part in time with Pete Carroll being there, of some real mediocrity, you would say. But they never really hit rock bottom, and they were able to really kind of retool relatively quickly when McDonald got there, and they were able to kind of clean out the cap a little bit and bring in some more of the players that would fit this system. And again, the draft that they had this year was absolutely phenomenal. But for both of these teams to be back here at this point, you know, you go back in football history to some of the rematches that have happened. You got Dallas Buffalo. I mean, you probably had, what, 90% of the same guys out there or some such from one year to the next. And even Washington, Miami, that was about a decade apart, but the league was different then. I think there was probably still more of a commonality, certainly organizationally. Don Shula was there both times with Miami, the different coaches for Washington at the time. But that was a game where, again, it took place at about a similar interval, but there was at least a bit more continuity between the teams in that era. Today, what's been necessary for both of these teams to get back here, the fact that neither head coach is still there, and that the coaches that were in that game that were celebrated as being at the top of the NFL, that they both, by the early 2020s, would have kind of worn out their welcome, so to speak, and getting replaced by these younger guys. It is remarkable that it's the same teams that were here a decade ago, because they traveled different paths to get here. And again, the amount of turnover in the organizations that they had from then to now really speaks to the continuity that they've had there. I know in the case of the New England front office, there's been tremendous turnover. But in the case of the Seattle front office, John Schneider has been a constant. And as much as I was getting to the point in the early 2020s of like, is this guy starting to live off a reputation? Not so much, because you look at the last couple of drafts. And again, Schneider has really shown his bona fides probably as a Hall of Fame GM based on this run.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other factor that I know you and I both understand explicitly is the ownership. Obviously, yes. You know, Seattle's been in, I think they have like, what is it, once Paul Allen died, they have like a board, I forget how.
The trust, it. Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, that's obviously going to be very hands-off, and just from my understanding, the trust was pretty like, yeah, we still want to win, we're open to spending money, so that clearly worked out. And then we know, you know, Kraft is never going to be someone that's going to, you know, it is never shy to spend money when he needs to. So that's, yeah. I mean, I agree with all of your other points, but I just think that's with some of the teams that we see as perennial losers, which is both of our teams, or I guess your former team, you know, the common trend there is ownership. And then when you look at these two franchises that have turned it around in pretty record time. And like you said, back, you know, a decade later with entirely new makeups, I think the only consistent marker is the owners.
It is. And, you know, we've been hearing in the last couple of days, by the way, in terms of Seattle and the ownership, when we say that the team is owned by a trust, I think what that actually means is that Paul Allen was like, I trust that y'all won't hang on to this indefinitely and we'll sell the team and give the proceeds to charity like I wanted.
Yeah.
And they have not lived up to that at this point in time. Again, fair is fair on that point. They were waiting out. I think King County was going to be entitled to a certain amount of the money based on the lease of when Lumen Field was built. So they were waiting that out. But, I mean, what's their excuse now? And I've already seen the jokes about Roger Goodell after the game holding a live auction for the franchise on TV. I mean, that would probably be a better lead out rating.
The kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, exactly. This is where we get the dark money coming in from the Saudis. So yeah, I mean, you know, as much as I think they're going to draw pretty good ratings from the Olympic post show, I think they'll draw even better ones if it ends up being that kind of auction on TV. But in terms of some of the other oddities of this game here, these are always the kind of things that I have my eye out for. One of the things always is that I'm looking for is sports history between the cities. Ultimately, that Super Bowl is, I think, pretty much the extent of it at this point. There's not really anything else in any other sports that you could point to. I mean, you know, maybe the Red Sox and the Mariners. I think they might have met in the playoffs at one point in the late 90s, but that wouldn't be enough to really stir the drink here. But as far as I look at when a team is playing a Super Bowl in the stadium of somebody in their division, this century, teams are 3-2 when going to a divisional rival's place to play a Super Bowl. You will remember, Derek, from your vantage point, Seattle's one of the losers in this one because they've played at an NFC West place once before and came up short. So that is, a matter of fact, I think that's actually the game we're talking about here, I believe. That was New England. So
yeah, that was here in whatever it was. University of Phoenix Stadium at that time, now State Farm. But yeah, so 3-2, it sounds like it's there's not really much to derive from that. But I am curious what the stats would be on the travel. Now, granted, it's the Super Bowl. You have 2 weeks in between, you know, mm-hmm. the conference. So it's probably negligible, but there's got to be, I mean, there's something there in terms of New England has to travel across the entire country. Seattle, it's, you know, a pretty quick plane flight. They could possibly really want it to.
Yeah, and that's where now getting in for the course of the week, that will help. But you're right about that. That New England, it was probably going to take at least a day or so to get through the time zone changes here. So that's a factor as well. By the way, that 3-2 shrinks to 1-2 if we take away the cheat code of not playing in your own stadium, which of course famously had never happened in the course of the history of the Super Bowl until it happened in back-to-back years with Tampa and the LA Rams. So 1-2 if you're not playing in your own stadium, but it's a stadium in your division in the 21st century. One of the ones that I have seen here, much to my great bemusement as a Roman Catholic, that Seattle has made the Super Bowl the last several times there's been a new pope. I don't know what the correlation is. But yeah, I mean, that's Benedict Francis and now Leo. And that was being noted at one point during the season. Like, is this the year Seattle makes it back to the Super Bowl? Like, people were already pointing at that. Like, and that's the one where it's like, if you ask me for an explanation, I got nothing.
I got to remember that next time. next time there's a new Pope, and I'll put a massive future on Seattle. That's a crazy
yes. Yes, and you know what? If you're lucky, they'll be in the midst of a rebuilding thing, and you'll be able to get like a really nice price, like 200-1 on them or something. Yeah. But yeah, really be able to clean up on it, you know. So there's that aspect of it as well that is kind of, you know, interesting and unique. But as far as again, the game itself, the presentation of it on Sunday, this will be a thing where again it'll be on NBC. And it will be, again, they'll be going for that. Everybody always wants to know what the post show is going to be. They're going to be debuting a new show, whatever. No, much as they did a couple of years ago when they had the Super Bowl. I think it might – that was that – I believe that was that L.A. Super Bowl where they ended up going to the Winter Olympics for that one. It'll be the same thing. It'll be a Winter Olympics post show that night that they'll be doing. So the game on NBC, it will be the first time that Tirico has ever called a Super Bowl. He's been the pregame host previously, but it'll be his first time in the booth for a Super Bowl. And as far as how everything shakes out with the presentation of the game on NBC/Peacock, that, again, it will be very, very interesting. And again, in recent years, I think Collinsworth has become a little bit more of a polarizing figure as far as love him or hate him. Like, not everybody's really into his shtick as much, perhaps, as they used to be. So there will be people that will be looking at that.
I'm sure there'll be a prop bet of how many times Mahomes is mentioned by Collinsworth in the Super Bowl.
I was just about to say, there's probably going to be some kind of prop bets coming out of whatever Collinsworth has.
I would set it at 1.5 if I was okay. Setting that line.
Well, and here's the one too, is that, you know, when it comes to promoting your own stuff, which, I mean, I have a great fondness at heart for the hustler mentality of promoting your own stuff, going back to, I believe, when Ashton Kutcher was on, I forget which sitcom. I might have been when he went on 2.5 Men, and CBS caught him. I guess he got away with it at first. Like, he was putting stickers on his laptop that were like promoting some of his businesses. I'm like, that's the greatest thing ever. You gotta love that. In the case of Collinsworth, take the over on the number of mentions of PFF that there are during the game, Derek. I don't care high the over under is. Take the over.
Yeah, I mean, I noticed that. I think it was even more so back when he was with Al. I think he's toned it back a little bit with Tirico. But no, I mean, it's probably my least favorite broadcast team, though. So that's probably the most unfortunate. You know, I'm a big Aikman and Buck guy. I know some people are there's mixed opinions on Buck, and then, you know, same kind of thing with Romo and Nance. But no, it's. NBC does a good job. I miss the old days with Al and Collinsworth, but Tirico's fine.
Yeah, or further back, Al and Madden. I mean, that was really good too. I mean, if we could have had that, but you know, hey, they got the guy. What was it, Mr. Fagan from the 90s? That did the voiceovers for the NBA on NBC. They've been using AI for his voice for different matchups, which is hilarious because, like, there were no Pelicans in his lifetime. There were no Thunder. Like, the Thunder and the Pelicans live on Peacock this week. You know, AI Madden for the Super Bowl. I'm just putting it out there. I'd like to have that, but it's, you know, we're not going to. I'd rather have that than Collinsworth, quite frankly. But as far as that goes, yeah.
Speaking of, I wonder if they've already done that, the Madden sim of the Super Bowl yet. Because they always, like, I think the NFL does it, or Madden. They obviously do it together, but there's always, like, the sim that they'll do. I'm curious. Yeah. I haven't seen if they've done that one yet.
Okay, yeah, I don't think they have. I think we probably would have seen that if they had, so that might be a thing a bit later in the week perhaps. But looking at all of the different factors here for the game and looking at the anticipated outcome, I'm going to say in this one again, I don't think it's going to be a blowout, but I don't think it's necessarily going to be super close, nor is it going to be, by the way, one of these, like, and this is one of the most underrated things about the NFL, and not in a good way, is when there's a low scoring game that's somehow not exciting, like there, or not even low scoring. Let me rescind that. Any kind of close game that's not exciting. Yeah. I remember texting a couple of my friends that this Patriots Broncos game, and I was like, Roger Goodell at halftime needs to proclaim this an honorary Ravens Steelers game as far as being a boring close game. It takes a lot to have a close game where you're sitting there like, who cares, where it takes you completely out of it. I don't think we're going to see that, because a lot of times the elements play into that. I don't think we have any reason to expect that that's going to be the case this weekend in the Bay Area. I haven't looked at the weather stuff here, but there's probably no reason to expect anything out of the ordinary for early February in that stretch of NoCal. But as far as my sense of how the game is going to play out, I think, again, it's going to be more of the same of what we've seen from May and the New England offense through the course of the playoffs, playing against these great defenses. I don't think there's going to be a reason to expect that when they get against the best defense they've seen thus far, with all due respect to the Houston defense, that I don't think there's a reason to expect that it's going to be different. I don't think that Sam Darnold's going to turn into a pumpkin, as a lot of Patriot fans are hoping right now. So I'm going to say that it's a game that's a solid victory for Seattle, but I don't think a blowout. I'm going to say 27-13, which would be Seahawks plus the points and the under. What's your sense of how it looks overall, Derek?
Pretty similar, except I actually have it Seattle 20, New England 17. I actually think it is going to be – I think Seattle is going to control the game for the duration, but I do think it's going to be close. But in the in the sense that while it's close, it's going to be – I kind of see it. Not where it's boring, but – Seattle clearly will have control for the majority of the game. I think 2017, just because with the way these defenses are, if Drake May is a little more injured, not even if he comes out, if he stays in and he's a little more injured, it's going to be a lot more dink and dump, which I think is what their scheme's going to be anyway. And I think Seattle, you're going to see something similar along those lines. I do think they'll probably be one big bomb to JSN at one point. You know, I don't see either of the running backs, you know, breaking off for some big one. I saw someone naming a bunch of props that they were doing. I didn't even know if it was in jest or not, but one of them was the longest run will be 29 yards. I was like, that feels right. I could deal with that. And then with the lack of elements, I think teams will still opt to kick field goals. I think it's been a very I need to double check, but I'm pretty sure both of these kickers have been pretty consistent through the whole year. So I don't think anyone's going to be afraid to kick. So, you know, 20-17, that evens out to what, two field goals per team, like something like that.
One for New England then. So yeah. That would be the difference in the game. Now, here's what I want to know, Derek. Are you predicting, as far as 20-17, a backdoor cover where perhaps it's 20-14 and on the last play of the game they kick like a 56-yard field goal rather than throw the Hail Mary? Is that what you're saying?
No, not a backdoor cover.
All right. No backdoor on the 20-17. Okay. So, all right. Well, yeah. And so again, neither of us sees it as being a blowout. I see New England and the issues that they've had as being something that I think is going to keep them from being neck and neck through the course of the game. But again, it'll be interesting and fun to see how this plays out. And again, with these teams in this game, and as far as, again, how the ratings do, how this stacks up, again, in New England, I mean, they carry with them the name power, but it's a thing where there's like no continuity from the last time that they were in the Super Bowl, as far as anybody that, like, you know, Joe Average fan can glom onto. So, New England, basically, as a brand, I mean, they may, and those of us that loathe the New England Patriots and Boston fans and whatever, like, that's going to provide a certain floor, I think, for this game. But as far as whatever the ceiling is, you don't have the star power as far as, again, at least from a Madison Avenue point of view. And I'll use that term in a general sense as opposed to literally with folks who do a lot of advertisements and stuff. Although there is a strong correlation a lot of times as far as the Q factor between people that do that. But, you know, media darlings, Madison Avenue, whatever, this game's not brimming with that on either side. And to be honest with you, I mean, I'm kind of struggling to think of even one of them. I mean, and that's the thing, is that like there are some really, really great players in this game. There really are. But I'm struggling to think of anybody that I would say is going to appeal to the casual fan. And so that's the kind of thing where, again, you wonder if that's going to be something that bites into the ratings number or not.
No, I think it's the Super Bowl is always the most watched. I think if Denver had somehow won, then yeah, that would have hurt it. But then maybe that would have been compelling. But no, I think whenever you have New England, whether you love them or hate them, it draws a crowd. There's enough people, even if you're a casual, people are everywhere outside of the Northeast is like, no, I don't want to watch another Patriots dynasty. They're rooting against them. And then I don't think anyone has any ill will against Seattle outside of, you know, I don't know, maybe some fan in LA or something. The one, you know, diehard Rams fan in LA is just like, no, I hate Seattle, but no, I don't think it'll have it. I was curious though, you know, and then we talked about this last time too. Do you see any possibility that either anyone outside of the quarterbacks gets MVP, Super Bowl MVP?
I mean, I think there's a real live chance that it ends up being JSN if he's able to make some really good plays. Because here's the thing too, is that just the fact that we're talking about Sam Darnold having to kind of live down the reputation and everything like that, I think it's going to be one of those things where if push comes to shove, if it's really a toss-up between the two, it's not like there's necessarily going to be a feeling from the voters of like, well, any quarterback could have gotten him the ball there. But just the fact that, again, you know, Sam Darnold, I've been saying it all along. I mean, I think is an excellent quarterback and one that you can win a Super Bowl with and everything. But, I mean, JSN is turning into one of the truly transcendent players in the league. I mean, he was a top five player in the league at any position this past year and maybe even better than that. So just in terms of the greatness that he's shown, the level that he's taken his game to, you could see that. I really think that is the case here. I mean, I know there are others that have been talking. I've heard on the radio some talk about prop bets here. Like, oh, maybe you want to get it on Witherspoon or Gonzalez. I don't know about that. Like,
no.
If there's a decisive interception that's made or a pick six, if there's a pick six that wins the game. But, I mean, do either of us think the game's going to be won on a pick six? I don't.
No, if Aaron Donald didn't get it in whatever that was, 2019, 2020, against the Bengals, then no. It's like if the Patriots win, it's May, regardless of what happens.
Yes.
Seattle, yeah, you could say JSN is probably the dark horse. But I know Darnold is not – you talked about this. I know he's not a media favorite, but I still don't see a world where he doesn't get it.
Well, I'd like to think so, that if they win the Super Bowl and it's like, and there's really no scenario where they win the Super Bowl without him having an excellent game. So maybe not quite on the level of what he did in the NFC Championship game because that was really transcendent. But, I mean, an excellent game nonetheless – and, yeah, I would hope that he would win that, and I think that that's retroactively sort of giving him back some of the respect that he deserves. And I just think, again, what we're looking at here with this Super Bowl, that it is something where, it is not in any way, shape, or form the Super Bowl that people were expecting prior to the season, perhaps even midseason. I mean, I will, you know, say the FDH Lounge dignitary Ben Chu, like he said to me, I think, like back in October, he was looking at the schedule, and he was like, you realize New England's going to win like 14 games? And I was like, no, that right there is a clip and save prediction, you know? And what did they end up doing? He was exactly right. The schedule was the destiny, but that's one of the things I think at this point, again, that's one of the things that New England has to overcome in terms of the perception with the public to the extent that, again, I don't know how much the general public really keys on things like that. But, I mean, as far as folks like me and you and even people that don't take it quite as seriously as we do, we've all been frightfully aware of that the entire season. And, again, this will be something where a lot of times, and I've seen this Yeah, because, you know, charting this over the years, looking at strength of schedule and going into the playoffs, a lot of times these teams just have a glass jaw. And I think you've actually seen that more so with the New England offense through the course of the playoffs. They've just been able to overcome it because of going up against, you know, playoff Justin Herbert, C.J. Stroud, the way that he's devolving at this point, and then Jared Stidham. Going up against the Seattle team, which is going to be their toughest test by a magnitude of about 100, we'll see. And again, that'll be, look, every reason to put some respect on New England's name if they can do that this week. There's not a lot of precedent for a team that's played a schedule like that, that hasn't had a glass jaw when it's really counted. New England would be doing something very, very special if indeed they could get the W on Sunday.
100%. And I think, as much as I hate to say it, like that, it opens up, you know, the possibility of May being another Brady. Now, in reality, is he going to be another Brady? Probably not. But could they go on a run where he's there for a long time, takes him to a couple Super Bowls, maybe wins him a couple? 100%. So I don't know how they'll do it, how they'll, you know, kind of rise up and go against the dominant team that Seattle is after, like you said, going against basically, you know, three hospital bound teams, like with a mess of either injuries or just issues. So yeah, it would be crazy, but I don't know how Vrabel does it.
Well, yeah. And I saw there was a thing this week where there was a breakdown of like who New England played week by week. And it was like all these teams like fired coach, fired coach, fired coach, Jets, NFC South team. I mean, like, there was an asterisk on like a good part of the entire schedule when you go to look at it that way. So, yeah, I mean, we're not used to seeing that. I mean, teams have benefited from the schedule traditionally, but New England has benefited to a degree that is, and we'll have to see when it's all said and done here, if it's quite unprecedented or not. And I don't know if anybody goes through the schedules close enough to be able to kind of determine where this would fit historically. My sense is that this is pretty historic in nature, that a team's been able to ride that soft of a schedule this far, because usually in the playoffs it does catch up with you. And I have to say, I thought it was going to catch up with them to this point. The fact that, again, I'm not picking it to be
because they still kept playing bad teams even in the playoffs.
Well, that's it too. Yeah, I mean, like, what would they have done against the Bo Nix-led Denver Broncos, which
or Buffalo?
Yeah, but I mean, listen to me sound like I'm fluffing Bo Nix, but I mean, he's at least a legitimate quarterback as opposed to being a complete backup. So yeah, and Houston again, who was again my pick all year to come out of the AFC and make it to the Super Bowl, but again, Stroud and the way that he just kind of devolved has just really, you know, it can really kind of paved the way for New England under the circumstances there. So the Patriots have benefited from everything at every point along the way. And again, if they can overcome this monster in Seattle, which, as I've seen recently by certain metrics, that they are one of the better teams in the NFL in recent years, not just like they're one of the top two teams this year, which again, our statistical index will show you that, but that one of the best teams of the last several seasons in the NFL. If New England can run them down, it will be really, really, really noteworthy. And I think creating the circumstance that you're concerned about, and quite frankly, I'm concerned about as well. I mean, you might be the one that said it, but I share your concerns in this. Nobody wants to see another run from the Patriots here. But I mean, listen, think back to the first Patriots Super Bowl win. I mean, Brady wasn't really Brady yet at that point. That's what's frightening. I mean, he was enough so that they made it through the season. But I mean, that New England team was very vulnerable relative to the New England teams that evolved and kept getting stronger and stronger. Like, if this New England team to me is weaker than the 0-1 Patriots were. So it's like, if they can steal this Super Bowl, God help us all, Derek, because we may be in for another run from up there.
No, I refuse.
I think Seattle's going to help us out here. I think Seattle's they're going to take care of business. I'm saying 27-13. You're saying 20-17. We're both saying right in about the same ballpark here. So we'll see how this all shakes out. But again, always great to get you on to talk football, Derek. And thank you so much for being on for our Super Bowl preview today.
Thank you. One last thing. Any of the coach outside of the game, any of the coaching stuff surprise you?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, the Todd Monken thing doesn't surprise me because there's nothing more Browns than saying we're right and the rest of the world's wrong. How's that played out for them over a period of time? So, that to me was not surprising. The fact that again, and me having the Dolphins as my 1A team, a guy like Chris Shule is very near and dear to my heart because even if it might have been before my time, I hold the 72 Dolphins as being sacred territory here. So I Chris Shule going to the Steelers or the Ravens, I was like, no. So thankfully that didn't happen. Like, I would not want to see that guy go there, but I thought he'd get a job somewhere. So some of these things are kind of surprising as far as some of the coaches getting jobs and some of the coaches getting passed over.
Do you like Mike LaFleur? Do you think Cardinals are going to compete?
I think so. I mean, I don't know if I put him necessarily above some of the other names that I've mentioned. He was in that mix with them. So, I mean, it has the chance of that being right. I was floating a rumor for a while that that he was actually going to be the next coach in Green Bay and that there were going to be some very awkward family Thanksgiving dinners as a result of that. But you guys ended up snapping him up before it could come to that. A little bit surprising as far as some of the names that were out there and ended up not getting a job. A couple of, Shielhaus from the Rams ends up not landing anywhere. And same thing with the whippersnapper from the Jaguars. Both of them were really in the mix for the Browns job. McCarthy to Pittsburgh, in a way, was really, really surprising. But it's like
– it's not surprising. That feels the most Pittsburgh thing ever.
Well, aside from they usually go for the young defensive guy, as they've done the last couple times. But, I mean, yeah, as far as, like, the cautiousness of the move, and I've seen this described as it's like crapping your pants but changing your shirt, going from Tomlin to McCarthy. And I can't think of a better example than that. That, like, you think
Rodgers is the new GM, I guess.
Well, but like, you think that Mike McCarthy in the year 2026 is the guy to get you over the hump if you're the Steelers? If your whole thing has just been, getting to, like, constant mediocrity every year. I don't understand that one at all. And other than, and like you said, I mean, it feels very Steelers as far as the cautiousness of their regime, but it's very un-Steelers as far as not going for the young guy the way that they have the last couple of times. The fact that, Aaron Glenn somehow keeps his job. I mean, that's a thing where I pretty much marvel at that. So, yeah, the coaching carousel was very crazy this year. And generally speaking, when that happens the next year, it tends not to be as much because very few coaches get blown out after one season. Just a huge number of openings this year makes you think that there's not going to be as many next year. Now, obviously somebody like, Aaron Glenn, I mean, if you're going to bet anything out there, kids, bet on that guy having a very poor Black Monday after the end of the 2026 NFL regular season. But like, how many guys can you point to right now and say, yeah, that guy might well be gone after the next season? I mean, maybe Zach Taylor, but like,
Sirianni, if the Eagles completely implode next year, I could see them moving on. He's not that well liked.
I will tell you this, as a Clevelander, that what was very, very amusing to me, and I don't listen to a whole lot of national radio, but when I do, it might tend to be more so Fox Sports Radio, and particularly on the weekends. I generally find them to be a little bit better than some of the alternatives out there. And somebody who I had never thought to question anything about his takes, Anthony Gargano, who is also a local radio honk in Philadelphia. So I'll have to ask my good pal Joe Stazak what he knows about this guy. But this Anthony Gargano was saying, you know what the Eagles need to do is fire Sirianni and hire Kevin Stefanski. Like, what? You want to fire
a guy? I didn't say Tomlin.
No, he wanted Stefanski. And it's like, I know that Stefanski has the Philly area ties and whatever, but it's like, there's got to be more to it than that. And like, when I heard Stefanski's name in the mix for the Giants, I was just like, I can imagine that one. I mean, if there's a guy that might get fired by week three with the New York media, there's a guy that gets up there after every game that they lose and like, it's on me. I got to do a better job. The coach has got to do a better job.
It's
on me.
Is it too? Yeah.
Yeah. Like, how's that going to go over with the New York media? So, you know, the Atlanta media is, you know, I think a lot friendlier than that. So his shtick will endure for at least a little period of time there. But
I can see Tomlin or McDermott landing somewhere next year.
Like, yeah.
The Eagles, like one, I think, you know, there's a couple teams that, like the Eagles, where the team is good, but maybe they're getting tired of the head coach if they have another offer.
Yeah, and I will say also, too, promoting Brady in Buffalo, that was kind of a head-scratcher, too, because it's like if you're trying to shake things up here and get this team over the hump, I mean, that's as much of a continuity move as you could possibly make.
I've never seen a team just completely devolve, an organization, I should say, devolve with the speed that Buffalo has. Like in 3 weeks.
Yeah. Insane. They're crumbling going. I've never seen it happen with a team going into a new stadium where they're pointing towards it. And it's like, at this point, they look like a tremendous regression candidate for next year. I mean, you got the owner out there trying to defend his GM. Like, hey, he didn't draft that stiff at wide receiver. Don't blame him.
Who's still on the team.
So yeah, like, what are we doing here? So, yeah, I mean, they're a huge regression candidate. So, I mean, which obviously New England will be as well, because they're actually going to play a real schedule next year being a first-place team. But it's like the best thing that could – here goes New England's luck again, right? Buffalo implodes as New England has to play a first-place schedule. You know, my Dolphins, I'm hoping they know what they're doing with this Green Bay connection here. There's a reason to think that may be the case. And this, it's a combination that is going to focus on player development, which never was the focus under Chris Greer. Chris Greer is a guy who could have been, he should have been shot straight into the sun like 10 years ago. That guy sucks. So player development is going to be a necessary move for them. The Jets are still the Jets, famously. So New England's got two games on their schedule. They don't have to worry too much about going into next year. But, yeah, the coaching carousel, crazy as always. And just in terms of entertainment purposes, it will be interesting to see if Jim Schwartz lands anywhere that's on the Browns schedule the next year. I know me, you know, cue up the Michael Jackson eating popcorn gif right now with the thought of that one. And Todd Monken having to face the guy that he disrespected at his opening press conference the other day. But I never had the scheme for Jim Schwartz. It was Myles Garrett. Okay, I'm sure Jim Schwartz isn't too much of a red ass to remember that the next time you got to play his team. So, yeah, we'll see how all of these things go. But great, as always, to get you on the show, Derek. And we will be, I've announced on the show previously here, we will be lining up for the second year in a row with a live stream of the NFL draft. So with any luck, perhaps we can get you in the mix for that one there and have some fun going through the draft proceedings as well. But wonderful talking football with you all throughout the course of the season, my man. And I know we'll do so again over the off season.
Can't wait. Thanks.
Appreciate it, Derek. Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for checking out FDH Lounge mini episode 1904.